The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
You don't want it, you don't need it, but you're gonna get it anyway. The Kevin Sheehan Show. Here's Kevin.
That theme will be heard 3 weeks from tonight. That's NBC's Sunday Night Football theme, but NBC handles the Thursday night kickoff of the season game 3 weeks from tonight. The Chiefs as the defending champions against the very popular playoff pick before the season begins, the Detroit Lions. By the way, my bookie right now has Kansas City as a 7-point favorite over Detroit. This show today is brought to you by the Circa Million and the Circa Survivor Pools out in Vegas. The Circa Million is $6 million in guaranteed prizes. You pick 5 games a week, NFL games against the spread. At the end of the year, the best record takes home $1 million, but it pays out another $5 million to the top 100, and there are quarterly and season-long prizes available as well. The Circa Survivor Pool pays $8 million guaranteed to the winner or winners. A survivor pool, for those of you who don't know, you pick one team straight up, no spread, every week. If the team loses or ties, then you're out. If it wins, then you keep picking week after week until you lose. Now, you can't pick the same team twice. That's part of the challenge of the survivor pool. $14 million in guaranteed prizes. No rake, so if the entries go above the guarantee, all the extra money goes into the prize pool. Entries close September 9th, 2 p.m. That's the Saturday before the first full Sunday of the NFL season. You must register in person. I did at the Circus Sportsbook in Nevada, but you can make your picks from anywhere through a proxy. The Circa Million and the Circa Survivor contests out in Vegas. If you're out there, it's worth it. It'll provide a lot of fun for the upcoming season. And I'll be talking about my entries during the season as well. So, yeah, 3 weeks from tonight, the NFL season will kick off. 2 weeks from tonight, the college football season really gets underway. There is a week zero, but the full week one kicks off 2 weeks from tonight on Thursday night football with a big Thursday night slate. But I was thinking just about, you know, Arrowhead and the opener on September 7th. 76,000 at one of the great outdoor stadiums in all of North American sports. I mean, what a fan base the Chiefs fan base is. But they will be there openly mocking Native Americans, doing the tomahawk chop, you know, chanting as they're doing it. You know, that scene year in and year out, both there and in Atlanta for the Braves and at Florida State with Florida State fans, that particular, you know, situation and scene is apparently fine with, you know, the NFL and Major League Baseball and college football and the corporate sponsors of those teams. And of course, you know, we've seen over the years a lot more outrage. In fact, you know, 100-1 more outrage over the team's name here than actually openly mocking Native Americans. By the way, I looked something up because I've said this too a lot, that, you know, the mic drop moment for those that hated the name is it's dictionary defined as a racial slur. I don't know why I haven't done this before, but I just looked through a few dictionaries, Merriam-Webster, dictionary.com, a couple of smaller dictionaries. Here's the definition in all of those. Redskin, noun, used as an insulting and contemptuous term for an American Indian. I don't see racial slur mentioned in any of the definitions. I don't even see the word insensitive mentioned, racially insensitive. Insulting and contemptuous are not great, you know, terms. That doesn't make the definition super happy or super rosy. I'm just saying that when you hear people say dictionary-defined racial slur, you know, many dictionaries don't use racial slur in the definition. Insulting and contemptuous aren't nice things, but they aren't racially tinged either. Anyway, that's it on the name issue today. Did we even discuss it yesterday, or did I just do that on radio? Well over 100,000 signatures right now with the Native American Guardians Association petition to change the name. I want to start with something, and then John Keim's going to jump on with us, and then Dave Jagler is going to jump on with us. The Nats beat the Red Sox last night. Now, by the time you listen to the podcast, they may already be finished with the Red Sox game today, but the conversation was more just about how the Nats have played and how they've kind of overachieved, and really when will they begin to contend? Could it come as early as next year? So John Keim coming up next. We'll talk about the 2 days in Baltimore, and then Dave Jagler will join us as well. So I'm going to start with this. ESPN.com put out the ceiling and floor records for all 32 teams in the NFL. They used 20,000 simulations of the entire season and the ESPN Football Power Index to come up with the ceiling record, meaning the best case, and the floor record, meaning the worst case. And I do have a bit of a problem with what they have for Washington. Now, let me give you the NFC East. Philadelphia's ceiling is 13-4. Their floor is 8-9. Dallas's ceiling is 12-5. Their floor is 7-10. The Giants' ceiling is 11-6, and their floor is 6-11. And then you get to Washington. The ceiling, the best case, according to ESPN.com and the 20,000 simulations, is 10-7. Now, just so you know, there were simulations that showed better than 10 wins, but they took kind of an average of the higher end and blended it into what they believe a realistic ceiling is. And then their floor is 5-12. Ceiling 10-7, floor 5-12. Ceiling 10-7, floor 5-12. And then there's something written here called the biggest X factor, and it's the offensive line. By the way, this was put together by all of the ESPN reporters that cover each team. So John Keim put this together for ESPN, and I'm going to address this with John when he's on with me in the next segment. So I don't have a problem with the ceiling. I actually think 10 wins is totally reasonable. You know, we take the injury part of the conversation out, obviously. You know, a team that gets ravaged by injuries and loses more man games than anybody else could win two games or three games if they start early enough. And, you know, by the same token, if they don't have any injuries and they stay super healthy, maybe the ceiling's a little bit higher. But I think, you know, and I've said, I think they can win 10 games. For me, the X factor is really obvious. It's Sam Howell. It's the quarterback. The offensive line, I don't even know if it's an X factor because I'm just assuming at best it's going to be average. you know, and maybe worse than that. Chase Young's a bit of an X factor. He could really end up being a major playmaker for an already excellent defense. But the quarterback, to me, is the obvious X factor. If X factor means like wild card, like if this particular player plays really well, they hit the ceiling or beyond. And if this player doesn't play really well, it's more closer to the floor. That's what I would consider X factor. Anyway, the real problem that I have with this is the floor. I just don't see, again, absent of major injuries, I don't see how they win less than seven games. I'm going to play the over on them at 6.5. I am. I played the over last year and hit that. Predicted 8-8-1, if you recall. I just look at last year's team and I'm like, that team won 8 games with a dismal offense and dismal quarterback play. I mean, could it be worse offensively than it was last year? I guess it could be, but would it be 3 games worse? No. I don't see a 5-win team. And the funny thing is, if Sam Howell's not the right guy and they're not going to, you know, make a run towards respectability with a young quarterback or a playoff berth with maybe Jacoby Brissett or Sam Howell, then I'd rather them have that floor be 5 wins. I just don't see with the talent they have on this roster. And then considering last year's, you know, they were 7-5. Let's not forget, they were 7-5 and they were holding down the 6th spot of the 7 playoff spots in the NFC. I mean, they were the favorite through 12 games to make the postseason. They were a favorite to make the postseason. And then the Giant games came and the Cleveland game came. I just don't see anything personally less than 7 wins. Again, injuries change that completely. And if the quarterback, if Howell is truly awful, and they go to then they're going to go to Jacoby Brissett, and he won't be truly awful. And by the way, I don't think Sam Howell's going to be truly awful, but I have no idea what he's going to be. Have no idea. Anyway, that's where I would say ESPN is off. I'm not sure how they got to a floor of 5-12, other than the national media just looks at the quarterback situation, and to a certain degree, they look at the head coach, and they say, yeah, I mean, they're not that good. That's why their over-under in Vegas is 6.5. But I just look at a team that won 8 games last year and say they can't be worse than they were last year offensively. And even if they are a little bit worse, it won't be 3 games worse. John Keim, right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This segment of the show brought to you by MyBookie. Football's back, so is a winning season at MyBookie. NFL, college football, and a brand new cash-out system give you options to bet and win all season long. First two legs of your parlay hit, cash out early, and use the funds on another bet or let it ride for the chance at a bigger payday. Use early cash outs as a tool to stay in control of the action at MyBookie. Now, to get started, go to mybookie.ag now. Register for the account for free. When you're ready to make that first deposit, use my promo code KevinDC. That's KevinDC. You'll grab a welcome bonus on the house. And when you use promo code KevinDC to claim your deposit bonus, you'll get a free chip to use in the MyBookie online casino. Bet anything, anytime, anywhere, only at MyBookie. By the way, tonight, preseason action in the NFL at MyBookie. Philadelphia is a 3.5-point favorite over the Browns. Deshaun Watson's not playing in that game. I have no idea why. All right, let's bring on my good friend John Keim from ESPN, at John_Keim on Twitter. He's got a podcast as well called The John Keim Report. You can get that anywhere you get a podcast. So these 2 days, John, just completed against Baltimore were big days. You know, we had been talking about these two joint practices as almost as big as any of the preseason games, the first or the second, that this would be, you know, a bit of a mark during training camp and a bit of a tell on what kind of team Washington might be. But more importantly, it would be kind of a hurdle for Sam Howell to clear. So let's start there. How were these 2 days for Sam Howell?
I think they were pretty good. You know, one thing with Howell that you don't see is you don't see a kid who's overmatched. And I think that's a good place to start for them, you know, because we've seen quarterbacks here who don't look good or look overmatched or throwing the ball all over the place, and that wasn't him. You know, there wasn't – is he perfect? Of course not. Nobody is, right? But he wasn't I felt like his timing – was really good on Tuesday, you know, and I think there were definitely plays he made on Wednesday, some in hurry up situations, in other, some other drills that was still really still good. So I thought it was a good 2 days for him and the offense, where there's still some questions about everything, right? I mean, he's going into his second year, one NFL start, revamped offensive line, new offense. It doesn't click overnight. And so there are going to be some questions going the season, but he did nothing with his group on the job the last couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, like I had described the on radio this morning as this was like the hurdle to clear. You know, if he cleared these 2 days in Baltimore with nobody alarmed by anything having to do with, you know, his understanding of the offense, his ability to communicate the offense, et cetera, and then, you know, everything pre-snap, everything post-snap, then that was it. Like, then he had cleared the biggest hurdle on his way to Arizona. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I do. And I think you can throw the Browns game in there on Friday as kind of the appetizer for all that, because he did play three series, and there were situations in there where you get a chance to see how is he doing? Where is he with his footwork with X, Y, and Z, right? So you start there, and then you follow into here, and he's continued to build on things that he has done. And so, yeah, I think this is – now, when they name him the official starter, I think that, to be honest, Kevin, like, that's more for people outside of Ashburn than inside. Because, again, he's done nothing. And Ron Rivera was asked on Wednesday about it. He's like, all he has to do is continue doing, showing what he's shown. So, you know, there's really, like, that official designation will happen at some point, but it really is almost, I don't want to say irrelevant, but we all know it's going to happen, and nothing has been shown that it would go otherwise. But yes, in part, that's in part because of how he looked. If he had gone out there against Baltimore and it's like, oh, no, he's really struggling, and it's not just because the line's giving him pressure, it's because he's not making the right reads or the footwork is all over the place, that would be cause for alarm. That didn't happen.
Yeah, and as it relates to, you know, Ron not, you know, naming him officially starter when he was asked about it yesterday, my personal view is, I mean, I don't really get all worked up over it. We know he's going to be the starter.
I mean,
this hasn't been a competition for the starting position. But with that said, do you think he's going to announce Sam Howell officially as the starter for Arizona soon?
Soon, yes. But when, don't know. it could come after the Ravens preseason game, so which is Monday. You know, not necessarily Monday night or Tuesday morning, whatever, but it's at some point after that. They're not in any rush to do it because, again, like, there's nothing. He's taking every rep. He's going to continue to take every rep. Sometimes you're going to name that starter so that way that guy can now, he's going to get all the reps from here on out. He's been getting all the reps. Nothing is going to change. And again, it's just a formality whenever it is. So whether it's Friday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it's going to be. So nothing is going to change between now and then and or after to, you know, it's like, okay, now you got to start getting ready for the season. Give him a few weeks of reps. He's already getting every rep. So, you know, I think soon is the operative word. It's just a matter of when it is. It the sale definition of soon, which we kept hearing for about 4 months, or is it the actual definition of soon, which is over the next week or so, yeah. I would say. You know what I mean? Sometime in that time.
So,
it could be any time.
I want to ask you this question, but as I'm thinking about it, I don't even know if it's fair because there's really not an apples-to-apples comparison because Brissett hasn't been, you know, in a lot of, you know, first-team reps
no.
and didn't. But
right.
But it, you know, how we kind of talked about this going in that, you know, as long as it was even or maybe, you know, Sam was just a tiny bit behind, then it was going to be all it would be Sam Howell in the opener. How would you measure how each has done relative to the other?
That's hard because
right.
of what you said. It's
yeah.
not, there's no direct comparison. And while Howell is facing a much tougher defense in the starters, Brissett is going with lesser players around him. So I think the way I look at it is what is each showing and what does each offer? And the one thing they've known with Brissett, first of all, I think Brissett was a terrific signing. And I think he's been he is a true pro in every sense of the word, and he's going to be good for Howell in the role that he's in right now, which is as a mentor. And if he has to go play, they know what they're going to get. They offer different skills. And I think the whole thing has always been, to me, it's always been a competition with Sam, where is Howell now versus where can he get to? Where, you know, where is he at with his footwork? Where is he at with his timing? Where is it an experience thing? Is it a talent thing? Is it a brains thing? And so when you look at it with Howell, like everything that they talk about typically is an experience thing. I mean, he's a smart kid. Works awfully hard, and so it's just a matter of get him more experience to get him the timing and the rhythm down here. Brissett, I think the whole thing has been is that you know who he is. And again, I think Howell is a more mobile quarterback. Brissett, I think, is going to probably maybe take care of the ball a little bit better throughout the course of a season would, just based on his history. But I think Howell's done a good job of taking care of the ball and did so against the Ravens. So I kind of look at it that way, and who has the higher ceiling right now? Well, it's Howell, because we don't know where he can get to. We know what Brissett offers, and I think if they had to go play, I think they'd be fine with him. But I think for the long range, you still look at Howell for the long term. So it's hard to say how they've done. But I think Brissett, I will say this, like Brissett has gotten better. I think they've each progressed in their knowledge of the offense. For example, early in the spring, when we first went out to the OTAs, I remember the first 7-on-7 session I saw Brissett, and he had to tuck and run a lot of times on a 7-on-7, which is not what you want. I mean, you're going to still do it occasionally, but you don't want it a lot because it's usually an indication of unfamiliarity with the offense or uncertainty with what you're seeing, et cetera. And it was noted because, like, okay, what does that mean? Well, you saw him progressively get better with that, and his knowledge of the offense progressively got better, and you saw that fade away. Again, it's going to happen every once in a while for both quarterbacks, but you saw that really improve. And so I think both their knowledge of the offense has increased. But it's just, you know, what Howell offers, he has a good arm, he has pretty good instincts, and he has the mobility. So when you look at all that, it's why they're going to ride with him. And the snaps that Brissett has received with the first team, which was leading in the Browns game, it was just a handful, and it's really just like a, hey, just in case you need them, you want to have them to have some experience with some of that group. So, yeah, I don't know if that necessarily answers your question, but it's because I think it's difficult, but I was trying to look at what each one offers and how they progress.
Well, I actually think you gave me and everybody listening some information on Jacoby Brissett and the fact that it's improved for him as well. You know, Ron said yesterday when asked about all of this, when he wasn't answering the question directly about naming Sam Howell the starter, he said, "We're really comfortable with the quarterback room. A, do you believe him? And B, how do you feel about the comfortable about the quarterback room?"
Well, I think I think comfortable is a pretty good word, because first of all, it is a good room, and again, you have essentially a coach next to him in Brissett, in addition to the other coaching you're getting. The question, though, is to what level can this group perform? I think Brissett is an excellent backup, so you start like that's they feel like they're in good hands there, because he's a guy. And even if this last week had gone wrong for Howell, let's say he just didn't show the progress they needed, then you could go to Brissett knowing, because of how, you know, he's been in this league a long time, he knows how to prepare, he knows how to do this, it wouldn't take him long to get to where he needs to in a few weeks, right? So I think that's a comfort level for any coach. The question then, and I think they feel really good about how Howell is progressing and where he's come over the course of a year. When he was at this point a year ago, and it's funny because I think some people don't realize how far he had to go just with footwork and everything, and it's like, that's a big deal, and he has come a long way with it, but to his credit, he's worked himself to come a long way. So I think you feel comfortable. I think they feel comfortable that he can play in this league. But again, to what level and when? So I think it can be a good situation. But again, there's still, Kevin, a lot we don't know about him, because he really, you know, you can have all the faith in the world you want in him, but until he goes out there and you handle situation X, situation Y, situation Z, and then more teams get tape on you, then they try this and this and this against you, how do you handle that? That's when we're going to learn even more about him. But I'll say this, like, you know, we've seen a lot of quarterbacks come through here. I mean, I think he's got traits that you say this kid can be good. But when? I don't know. So the comfort is in his progression so far, as much as anything.
By the way, what you just said was the one I have issue, and I'm going to bring it up to you here in a moment, with your floor, not so much your ceiling, but your floor in the ESPN column today, and your X factor. But I'll get to that in a moment.
All right. So the floor is not set by me. Just so you know.
Oh, okay. Well, hold on. Don't answer that, because it's a good tease for people to keep listening. Because I've already discussed it in the open.
We'll talk about that in
the open of the show. Yeah. But tell me about Eric Bieniemy. Is there any real drama around anything associated with Eric Bieniemy or not?
I don't think so. I mean, nothing has really changed since, like, the comments. And to be honest, it's kind of become a forgotten thing. You know, he's going to be the same guy on the field, and he has been the same guy on the field. You're going to hear his voice all the time, and I don't think he's ever going to let up, and he's made that clear. So it's always been on the players to adjust, and you just don't hear a lot. And when I talk to people close, a lot of these players, some players who I thought, well, maybe this guy was one who complains, like, no, this guy really likes it. So, you know, I don't think there's, you know, Kevin, if there's going to be an issue, it will be if they start off slow and the offense is really sputtering.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's like, players want to see progress. And I mean, I go back to when Marty Schottenheimer was here, and not many, you know, I don't know how many people listening remember that year, but they were terrible in the preseason offensively. They were 0-5 and the offense was sputtering, to the point where one time we're sitting in the press box and one piece of paper is floating down from above, and somebody joked that there goes Jimmy Ray's playbook, and Jimmy Ray was the offensive coordinator.
Yeah.
Cause like they were really bad, so they're 0-5, and people were ready to mutiny against Schottenheimer. That's the worst I've seen covering this team for a first-year guy. And then they won 8 out of 11, and that all went away except for a couple people.
Yeah.
So the point is, like, production and results are going to matter in this situation, because if you're going to ride guys really hard, which there's nothing wrong with, but you need, but then you need to see the results. And so if they do, now I think they're also smart enough to know you have a young quarterback and then you have a new line, and that, and the whole thing takes time to put together. But if you got to that point, let's say they start off again, start off slow, have some issues, that's when you say, okay, is there anything right now? I just, again, it had, I mean, really since that day, it hasn't really been a topic. It doesn't seem like, you know what I mean? So I don't view it as a problem.
Yeah, that it was nice that Marty had all the support from ownership too as he was going through that 5 start.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good decision to get rid of him and John Schneider.
Yeah, great decision. Anyway, thank you, Dan, for that one. Thank you, Fred Drasner, who really couldn't stand Marty.
Yeah.
All right, so offensive line, how big of a concern is it for them and for you?
Well, certainly, I've been using a big question because, and I'm going to say it this way because there's, to me, there, listen, Andrew Wiley has to be better than he was against the Browns. Okay. I felt like the run blocking at times against the Browns was pretty good. And I think in practice at times it's been pretty good. And, you know, so I think there are a few reasons for that. I think the interior is starting to do a nice job. You have to get the left guard settled. Sadiq Charles keeps going in and out with the injury. Can Chris Paul do it? They're different styles, or they have different strengths. But I think it can, you know, the question I have is, I mean, it's, you have starter or new starters at 4 spots. That can be difficult. And you don't have the young stud on that line. I think Cosme can be a good player at right guard. But you have a line that has, you know, do you have the tackles that can match up with the pass rushers in this division? Because it is a difficult one in that regard. So I have questions about that, and how much will this, cause, and this is where, this is, here's the parts, like, individually you can look at it and say, okay, there's a problem. Like, again, how is Wiley going to do? Is that a concern? Is that a question? How can you help him? And what we don't see yet is the effect of game planning, and I think there will be an effect on that. How, you know, when you're in a situation where you're not sure if you're running or throwing, how is that going to play out? How does Howell handle the RPO handoffs, for example? And I'll point to the game against the Browns, where the first handoff looks like a bad job by Leno letting guy inside. The reality is Howell's got to get a deeper drop on that to sell the possible pass and keep Robinson out of a direct path where he's got one place to go, which is angling forward right into the defender. So, like, little things like that, how is that going to help them? And, you know, the chips and all that. So that all goes into it. So I think there are ways you can help alleviate issues on the line, but is it going to be good enough? And I don't know. I don't know that we can say that yet. I do think there's some areas that can, you say, okay, this can grow. I think Nick Gates can be solid at center, Cosme at right guard, you know, but what's everything else going to look like when it goes? So I don't know. And whether you want to call it a question or concern, it's going to be one that they have to answer. And they have to, what I know, Kevin, is that line has to be, you know, it should be better than last year. It's really hard not to be. But to what level? They've got to play, at least be an average line, and I think they'd be okay. But will they get there? And I just don't, you know, I think it's a little bit early to say that.
Do you have any feelings one way or the other on Chase Young so far?
I think he's shown some pretty good things. I think he looks good off the ball. I mean, we didn't see him in Baltimore. I know he was limited against the Browns. It was like 4 snaps, but there were a couple rushes that I liked where, you know, the big thing has been the stutter steps, right? And I know, like, in 2021, before the injury, he would take these big stutter steps. And what I saw against the Browns is a little bit more decisiveness, right? And, like, there may be a little bit of a stutter, but it wasn't pronounced like it had been. Because when it's pronounced, you lose all the power in your hands, and he becomes a less violent player with his hands, and that's the strength of his game. So if there was a rush he had where he attacks the left tackle of the Browns, Wills, and just kind of gets him a little bit on a slight stutter, but a quick one, and then attacks, I think, to the outside, or it gets inside and puts pressure on. Oh no, gets around him, almost sacks Deshaun Watson, and so, like, that's the kind of stuff you want to see from him. So I think you've seen that from him during camp, like more of what you would hope to see from the number two pick in the draft. He's got to, you know, he's got to be on the field. And he, I think with the stinger, they, you know, it's always the abundance of caution. But I think he does at times, not at times, I think he's looked pretty good coming off the line. So, you know, I think we'll see where that translates. But, he doesn't look like the knee is holding. It doesn't look like the knee is holding him back. It's just a matter of, like, getting back to how you rushed as the second half of your rookie year in particular.
All right. I want to finish up with this floor ceiling thing from ESPN today that you were a part of, but maybe not as big of a part as I thought you were. But real quickly, defensively and offensively, give me the players other than the so-called star players that have really stood out in a positive way.
All right. Well, I guess Brian Robinson would be a star player, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's a starter, so,
I think he stood out, and I'll say this, like, Brian Robinson, the pass catcher, has stood out. How's that? And because I think he's going to be more of a threat in that way. His hands are really good. He's running some pretty good routes, so I think that's an area that you can enhance the offense with. I think Giami Brown has had a nice summer, so that would be another guy that I think you could say, okay, because if Brown can become a bigger part of the offense, even if it's just like a couple plays a game, that's all he has to do, because you have other guys around you who are going to do more. Jahan Dotson would be a name player, so I'm not going to put him on there because I think that kid's really, really good. But Brown would be the guy who says, you know, they like him in the system, and I know he's reunited with Howell out there, but it's as much about the system and the scheme they feel fits him in terms of, because of his speed. He can get deep. He can run some of the stuff underneath the slants and stuff that they like. So, on defense, so the guys who stood out, like, as far as the starters go, I think St. Juice has been really, really good. I mean, that guy, he has stood out to me
right
as much as anybody in the defensive backfield. Kendall Fuller's been solid, but he's doing what he has done. He's solid and he's smart and he plays that way. But I think St. Juice, the reason I bring him, because I think he looks like a better player than he was last year. And he has the ability to go inside. He can cover in and out, but he's playing confident. He's moving confident. He uses his length when he's covering inside. He's quick inside. So if he has to play in there, he has strengths that can help him in there, but he just seems to be moving well and moving with confidence. And when guys do that, good plays result. So I think he's the guy that has jumped out. Andre Jones of the rookies, I think, has flashed without a doubt. Those are the guys. And Derek Forrest is another guy. Like, I think he's had a really good summer as well. Going in, I wasn't sure where he was going to fit, but he's maintained a role with the starting group so far. So he's done a nice job too.
All right. ESPN, I talked about it in the open. They had their ceilings and their floors for all 32 teams. Their ceiling for Washington was 10-7. The floor was 5-12. And the biggest X factor was the offensive line. So tell me real quickly, which part of this did you have responsibility for and which part
X factor.
You wrote the X factor?
Yes.
How did you pick the offensive line over Sam Howell after what you described about 15 minutes ago?
Well, the X factor to me is, like, they have to be good. So I don't, like, maybe there's a, I mean, I think Howell's going to, I don't have a lot of doubts about Howell. I mean, as far as, like, can he play in this league? I think he can. So I would have more questions about the line
okay.
being good. That's why I went there.
Okay.
So I like what I've seen from Howell, and I think the kid's going to be able to play. It's just, like, when can he be good? And so, yes, I mean, well, the other thing is, you know, I think the X factor was a non-QB X factor as well. So that was other part of the equation.
Oh, okay.
Because the line has to be good. If the line plays to a certain level, then I think they can be a solid team. Because you look at the defense, we know what they have there. I think, you know, if you want to look at the linebackers and say that, I mean, I think Jamin Davis has progressively done a nice job this summer. But you can look at that and say, that's an X factor, because if you're Davis with that kind of skill and talent, You need to make, you behind that line, you better make some plays. So, but I think for the team overall, it's that line. They, you know, and you know, so if they do, they have enough depth there.
Yeah.
Because something always happens, right? But no, I, and it was a not, yeah, it was a non QB X factor, and that's why I went there.
Okay. I just, you know, when you described Sam Howell earlier, it's kind of the same way I feel, which is I have no idea once the game starts. I have
right.
no idea what we're going to get. And that, to me, is sort of an X factor in recognition, by the way, that he has some skill and talent that sort of fits today's quarterback thing. I think the other X factor would be kind of Chase Young and what he means to the defense. Now, the biggest gripe I had, actually, I don't know how they could come up with the floor being 5-12. If you take injuries out of the equation, right? Because the injuries, if they happen, you could win two games. But assuming relative health, this is a team that won 8 games last year.
Was
7-5 with a dismal offense and dismal quarterback play. Like, I could see somebody saying, maybe the floor is 6 or 7. But because I'd put the floor at 7. I think 10-7 is fine, 7-10.
Yeah.
But they won 8 games last year with an absolutely underwhelming offensive football team.
I am with you on that, and that's, you know, and if they had asked me, now
okay.
I also know this is I don't know all the mechanics of how they do things or come up with it. And it, to me, that would be a things just go off the rails. There's a lot of injuries and et cetera. But when I looked at it, like, you know, is the line going to be a strength? Well, it's hard to say that at this point. But is it better than last year? Well, you know, you don't have Trey Turner out there, and you don't have Andrew Norwell, so I think it should be better. And you're not playing your fifth center at this point. So, you know, can they withstand anything? I don't know. But I do think, like, how – I mean, look at – I really enjoyed covering Taylor Heinicke. Enjoyed it, right?
Right.
But there were limitations on that field with him. And I think Howell will be a better quarterback. Now, the question is when. But so you take all that. The only thing where I have a bigger question is like, okay, the schedule is tougher. But it's also tougher for every NFC East team. And of the NFC East teams, they have the easiest of the four. It's still hard, but of the four. So if, I guess if you're taking that into account, but I think the defense, the second half of the year, you look at like the number of big, once they got rid of the William Jackson experiment, that secondary really got better, and they stopped letting up so many big plays.
Right.
And they were one of the best defenses in the league in the second half of the year. And I,
yep.
you know, if, as long as that continues, I'm with you. Like, I have said this, like the people who say 5-12, 4-13, like, I'm not sure what you're looking at. You know, and you know what also happens here is this, you have to win, right? You have to win at some point, because otherwise, anytime they're like, oh, there's all this change,
right.
Oh, they said this about the enemy, we're going to downgrade him, because I get this. There's a friend of mine who, like, every year, like, something will happen, and this is a reporter. He'll text me and say, 4-13. He did this last year, like, and he said the other day, he's like, 5-12. Like, dude, you said 4 wins last year. So at some point, you know what I mean? And I joke, and it's a joke, right? Right? But it's like, you know, but I think they get downgraded for some of that stuff. But again, you have to go out and win. And if they go out and do something this year, now then team people look at you differently as far as the floor. And I think like the Giants floor was like 6. I think they and the
yeah.
I think they're right there with the Giants. So yeah, if they had said 6 or 7, I'd say, yeah, 5 just feels like everything went way off the rails. And I'll say this, Kevin, like, this has been one of their best camps under Rivera. In fact, it's their best camp under Rivera. Because it's been the pace and the energy and the urgency has all been better. The practices have been more physical, and you can credit Bieniemy because he definitely came in and changed some of this. But it's been there's been an overall change, and I think because of these practices and the practices with the Ravens, I think they're going to be more prepared for knowing who they are entering the season than they have been under Rivera. So how much is that worth it? And that's something that I get to see close up. That others outside of here aren't going to take into account. And it may be something at the end of the year they say, oh, well, this is why Washington won 9 or 10 games. But I see it up front, up close, that I don't, you know, I had Nikki Javala on my podcast yesterday and asked her, like, do you feel more or less optimistic after at this point compared to going into camp? And I think it's, you know, about the same or more. It's certainly not less.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put the first couple of weeks here.
Yeah.
And there's
yeah.
more to go, including a game on Monday night. I mean, the Cincinnati game will mean nothing. Here's the bottom line. There's been nothing alarming injury-wise.
No.
There's been nothing alarming coming out about the quarterback. I think the biggest concern would be kind of, you know, is this offensive line, did they really do enough to upgrade it? And we probably won't
Correct.
Know that until they start
Correct.
To play games. So.
And Kevin, here's like, and the other thing is, and this, I don't want to get into a whole other discussion. I know you got to run me out, but
well, like, you got to go. You told me you had to go.
I've got to finish the story, but
I know.
You know, they'll be okay. So like, I looked at Howell and again, you and I have seen a lot of bad quarterbacks come through here, and I've seen guys who succeed, right? How did Kirk Cousins succeed as a fourth round pick? And you know, the way he succeeded, cause he worked his ass off and he's a smart quarterback. And I look at Howell and say, he's a smart quarterback who works his butt off. And like, so I'm starting there. And I think they're both tough players. I think Howell puts bad plays behind them better, certainly at this point in his career. But, you know, I think they also have the quick twitch arm talent that helps. You know, you get to your second read, see it, boom, go. That kind of stuff. So, and I'm not saying he's Kirk Cousins. My point is, how does a guy who's drafted Sure. outside of the first round succeed? I mean, Kirk Cousins has a, there's a, not that, you know, I know everybody is, he's controversial. Kirk Cousins is a quality NFL starter. And if they can get that from Howell at some point this year or whenever, then they're going to be in, they'll be in much better shape. But it's a question, you know, we've seen quarterbacks who haven't succeeded. And it always comes back to, are they the first in and last out? Well, oftentimes, no. What is their knowledge of the defense, et cetera? And so I think that's where Howell has, that's why I think this kid's going to be able, the kid can play. Because I think he has those intangibles and those traits that translate to success at some point in the NFL.
Great job. Appreciate it as always. John's podcast is a good one. The John Keim Report. You get it anywhere you get a podcast, same place you get mine. And, of course, follow him and read him at ESPN.com on Twitter at John_Keim. I will talk to you later. Appreciate this.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right, let's shift gears and talk some Nats for the first time in a while on the podcast. One of my favorites, Dave Jagler, voice of the Nats on the Nats radio broadcast. Next, right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Jumping on with me right now is one of my favorite broadcasters in town, Dave Jagler, part of the team with Charlie Slows on the Washington Nationals radio broadcast network. You can follow Dave on Twitter at Dave, JAGELER. Now, by the time some of you listen to this, the Nats might be on the way to winning a series against the Red Sox because they have an early start this afternoon at 4:05 in the getaway game for Boston. Boston. But I wanted to have you on because I've been talking about them here over the last couple of weeks. Is just one of this season's, you know, Cincinnati's in that category, a couple of other teams. But you wouldn't think of, I think, outside of this market, of the Nationals as a significant overachieving team so far through 2023. Is that a fair description? And if you agree with it, why have they overachieved?
Well, I mean, I think they've overachieved to what the preseason projections were, Kevin. And they haven't gotten the notoriety. You know, the first month of the season, it was Pittsburgh because they got off to that amazing start over the first month. They've come back to the pack. Then the Marlins have had some notoriety, and you mentioned the Reds. But because the Nationals haven't been near 500, they had so big a hole to climb out of, I don't think they're getting the national play as far as overachieving. But I think early on in the season, the way it started, the way that the offense struggled, you know, it looked like maybe that we'd be headed to calling another 100-loss season. So if you want to say they're overachieving, I could go along with that. But I think around the league, when you talk to folks that you know on other teams, coaches, players, you know, fellow broadcasters, the word is out that this team is much better than last season. And it's basically, you know, you're going to show up for a three-game series with the Nationals, and if you're going to win the series, you're going to have to play some good baseball. They're not just going to hand it to you. It was even early in the season, before the Nationals really took off, we were talking, Charlie and I, to Max Scherzer, and he basically said, "You guys aren't a laughingstock anymore." And that was Max's way of giving a compliment. It was kind of talking about negatively about last year's team, but he doesn't dole out comments easily. So the fact that the Nationals aren't laughingstocks, I took as a real positive. And they haven't been. So, they've played the best ball in the division record-wise here over the last 3 or 4 weeks. So you're starting to see the fruits of the labor actually turn into a positive in the win-loss category, more than just, hey, they played well and they lost a close game or dropped a tough series. Now you're actually seeing them win series against postseason contenders.
Yeah, I mean, they had their third series sweep in the last 7 or 8, over the weekend. So whether it's describing them as an overachiever or maybe people were just sleeping on them, why have they played the way they've played, especially, you know, those 2 games before the All-Star break and since?
Well, I'm focused on the guys who are part of the rebuild here and could be a part of the next postseason team here, and you're seeing those guys, and most of them are very young. They're going to go through their ups and downs in a full big league season, and right now the majority of those players are trending upward. And you mentioned that 2-game stretch against Texas before the All-Star break, that kind of corresponds to when C.J. Abrams right. went into the leadoff spot, and his season completely turned around, and the narrative on his season turned around when he moved to the leadoff spot, because his offensive numbers have taken off, his stolen base numbers have gone crazy. And coincidentally or not, because he's played with more confidence and better offensively, he's played much better defensively. He's only had 2 or 3 errors since basically July 1st. So focus on him first. K-Bert Ruiz, second. You want to be strong up the middle. I think he's been better defensively as the year has gone along. And the timing of his home runs and the fact that he has some emerging power is much needed, because when he was acquired, and we didn't know a lot about him, but we heard potential 20 home run power. Well, I think he ended up with whatever it was, 7 or 8 home runs last season. We didn't see that over a full big league season last year. We're starting to see that now. So when you're strong up the middle with Abrams at shortstop, Ruiz behind the plate, and then focus on the pitching. And, you know, it was a strong first half for Josiah Gray. He's, you know, had some issues here in the second half. Mackenzie Gore, his good starts are far and away better than anyone on the staff's good starts. His good starts are great starts, and you're seeing ace potential when he's on his game. Now, there are some negative starts mixed in there, and as he gets older and more mature and goes around the league another time or two, you're going to have more of the good starts and less of the clunkers. So you focus on those pieces, and not only are they doing well now, but you can see them doing well in the future. And then a couple of arms in the bullpen, Lane Thomas's emergence from a guy who basically the Cardinals just threw him in to get an aging and decrepit John Lester at that point. And Lane Thomas has been one of the best players on the team. So there have been a lot of reasons for positive thinking with this year's club.
By the way, when you mentioned C.J. Abrams moving into the leadoff spot, didn't they turn things around? I'm trying to think what year it was where Jason Wirth went to the leadoff spot. And it was very... It was very influential to an offensive comeback. What year was that? You would know.
Well, 2012, because right. That year he had come back from the wrist injury, and he had hurt his wrist against the Phillies early in the season. He didn't have his power, but you knew that Worth could give you a good at-bat and could draw walks and start a rally. So, yeah, Worth is one. And the other big one, even more recently than that, is Kyle Schwarber.
Right.
Basically, the month of Schwarber coincided with Davey Martinez putting him in the leadoff spot, which is something that Joe Maddon had done with the Cubs when Schwarber went through struggles. And actually, the Phillies copied that playbook last year. Schwarber was struggling. They put him in the leadoff spot in June, and he took off again. So, sometimes it's a different look. You know, I mean, you're talking about, you know, a power hitter in Schwarber and a guy with more power than Worth. But for Abrams, I mean, I think he profiles as more of a classic leadoff hitter. When you think back to what a leadoff hitter was, yeah, he can hit some home runs, but he can run the bases, create some havoc, and he's actually had some better at-bat quality. He's never going to draw a ton of walks like maybe the 1970s leadoff guy, but if he can get on base, and with the new rules, a single kind of turns into a double when he steals second. He's being very aggressive, you know, running early in counts after getting on base.
Speaking of Schwarber, he's still in that leadoff spot, and the Phillies are coming in this weekend, and they are a red-hot team. And Harper, by the way, last night, two home runs. By the way, just as a quick aside, I mean, Tommy John, after that incredible, you know, postseason last year, and back in June, I mean, I know he's not going to be, you know, Acuña Jr. is more likely than not, I think, going to be the National League MVP. But Harper, have we ever seen somebody come back that quickly and be as effective as he's been off of Tommy John? I know not pitcher-wise, but, you know, position player-wise?
Well, and not to correct you a little bit, but it was actually May 2nd was the day that he was back on the big league roster after having the surgery in November, because they played till the end of October in the World Series. He is the fastest recorded player returning from Tommy John surgery. Obviously, position players are going to come back more quickly than pitchers who are basically on a 12-month schedule, but he is believed to be the fastest to return to an active big league roster after Tommy John surgery. And you know, we saw him the first series in Philadelphia, he was kind of joking around with guys around the batting cage, hey, I'm basically a singles hitter now. So he was back, but he wasn't back. And with the two-homer game, maybe unfortunately for the timing, he might be back to being Bryce Harper, because he's kind of been, he's been good, but he hasn't been Bryce Harper yet. Maybe he is rounding into that form.
Yeah, I actually think they're a threat when we get to October. So back to Mackenzie Gore, and you said he's looked the part of an ace. Do you think he will be one?
I do. I mean, I love everything about him. I love the mound presence. I love the stuff. Even the emotion on the mound, sometimes it's channeled negatively, but when it's channeled positively, I think that's great. And last night we saw a maturation of his catcher, Ruiz. You know, Gore is cruising along. He has an issue to walk. He's pounding the strikes. And he walks the number nine hitter in the sixth inning in a 2-0 game. And immediately Ruiz went out to the mound, because you could see Gore slam the rosin bag down. And that's when he tends to get hard on himself. He's a perfectionist. Ruiz immediately saw that, went to the mound. Next pitch, he gets a double play to get out of the inning in the sixth. So there's a lot of growing and maturing that's happened. And the exciting thing is there is more to come, because like I said before, he's had these starts where, you know, he's a little bit wild. He's spraying the ball. Sometimes he goes 0-2. Hey, I want to strike this guy out. All of a sudden it's 3-2, and it's an 8-pitch at bat. They're trying to convince him that your stuff is good enough. If you attack the strike zone with your fastball, you're going to have success, and you're going to get quick outs. And that's what we saw last night. His pitch count was, you know, if not for the blister, and if not for this innings limit that he's on this season, he potentially could have gone 8, maybe 9 innings last night. He was that pitch efficient. So his good starts are ace-like. Now it's just a matter of having that happen a little more often.
Let's just say that, and I'm not going to predict a Cincinnati kind of year next year, but who knows? We've got, you know, Wood, and we've got Cruz hanging around, and maybe there is a superstar similar to what Cincinnati saw emerge. What's the pitching rotation when they are back in contention, at the very least because of Atlanta being in this division as a wild card contender? I know it starts with Gray and Gore, but what do you see after that?
Well, as an aside to what you're saying, before I answer that question, when you mention the names of Wood and Cruz, It's going to be an exciting spring training next year down in West Palm Beach, because this is the year. Next year, 2024, is going to be the year that those guys are playing in big league spring training games from day one. They'll be playing like the second half of big league spring training games, which normally for us are snoozers and really, really hard to do because, you know, it's players you don't know or players you're never going to see again. But next year, when Cruz and Wood and maybe Hassel and some others are playing in these big league spring training games, it's going to be fun, and I would encourage Nationals fans to come down to spring training next year, because you're going to get that chance to see them up close and personal, and next spring is going to be a lot of fun. As far as the rotation, yes, you want Gore and Gray to be a part of it. You want them to finish this season healthy and be a part of it next year. You know, Cade Cavalli is the guy. I mean, his injury was crushing when it happened in spring training this year, but if you think back in your Nats history, if last year was 2009 and this year is 2010 when they've started that step toward respectability, well, 2010, Jordan Zimmermann didn't pitch, basically, until the end of the season, because he had Tommy John surgery in 2009, and then Steven Strasburg blew out in 2010 and didn't pitch much in 2011. So maybe Cade Cavalli can be that guy that next year he's on the innings limit, and then in 2025 he's full go to lead this rotation with Mackenzie Gore. So Cavalli's got to be in the mix. Potentially in September, maybe we see Jackson Rutledge, 2019 first-round pick, had a terrific year at Double A, has made his way to Triple A. He's had a couple of good starts of late. Jake Irvin, kind of out of nowhere, wasn't maybe on the high prospect radar. As far as the consistency for Irvin since the beginning of June, he's been the most consistent national starter of the six guys that we've seen make starts. So I think Irvin has put himself in that discussion. And from there, you know, if you sprinkle in a veteran or two, we'll see how it plays out. But there's excitement about some of these young pitchers. And then now you fortify that with the wave of position players who we're going to see in big league camp next year. That gets you excited about 24 and 25.
It's a good thing that the Steven Strasburg innings limit in 2012 didn't blow up into a big story.
I don't remember talking about that at all, do you?
No. You know, it's kind of, in thinking about him, it's kind of tragic the way it's ended, but I still think the career he's had, I'll never consider it to be short of anything brilliant because of what happened in 2019 and really what he was in the postseason for this franchise.
Right. Well, you draft a guy 1-1, and he won a World Series for you. Now, there were some bumps along the way, and obviously what happened after 2019 is, as you said, I mean, you termed it a pretty good way. It's been tough, but I mean, you draft a guy 1-1 and he leads you to a championship, that's a home run. That's an absolute home run.
All right, last one for Dave Jagler. So we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but as you look forward, do you think next year it's possible that they're in a wild card contending position, or do you think that comes in 25?
Well, I mean, it depends what they do in the off season. I mean, this past year was kind of
right.
You know, picking up guys who had been designated for assignment in other places, Dom Smith, Jamer Candelario. Candelario was a big hit. He played well and was traded for a couple of prospects. Let's see what they do for the offseason. But if you look at, you know, if we kind of have the parallels in Nationals history I was talking about, you know, if 2022 was 2009, 2010 becomes 2023. In 2011, the Nationals finished 80-81. Now, that's not going to get you in the postseason, but with the expanded postseason format, back in 2011,
contention.
There was only one wild card.
Right.
There's three wild cards now. And if you look at where the National League third wild card might be this year, you're talking maybe 84, 85 wins. So if you're in contention for 500 around the trade deadline, you're in wild card discussion, unless there's a drastic change in the standings going forward to next season. So absolutely, I would... You know, if we take in mind what they could do in the offseason, if that gradual step forward happens and they're able to, you know, jump up, like, you know, if they're going up 14, 15 wins this year, if they can make that jump of even 9, 10 wins, you're right around 500 late in the season, then yeah, you're in the discussion.
Thank you for doing this. Dave is so good at what he does. And that broadcast team of him and Charlie has been sensational for years. At Dave Jagler, JAGELER on Twitter. I appreciate it so much.
My pleasure, Kevin. We'll talk to you later.
Nats are going to have a chance to play spoiler the rest of the way, too. I mean, they've got 7 games with Miami. They've got 3 games with Toronto. They've got games with Milwaukee. They've got games with Baltimore and the Dodgers and the Braves. Now, you know, the Braves and the Dodgers are safely in as division champions, and the Orioles are going to be in the postseason, but maybe not as a division champion. But, man, the schedule is pretty tough for them the rest of the way, but they have been playing really well. I enjoyed that with Dave. All right, that is it for the day. Back tomorrow.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.